Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business, the podcast we do here at Risky Biz HQ every week, where we talk to Tom Uren about what he has written for us in his Seriously Risky Business newsletter. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Patrick. How are you?
Good, good. This week's edition of Seriously Risky Business is brought to you by Resourcely. And of course, we would like to thank Lawfare and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation for supporting Tom's work with us here at Risky Biz. And mate, you've written up a couple of major pieces in your newsletter this week. The first is about the CSRB report into the Microsoft breach that happened last year. This report was amazing. Microsoft got a real paddling from the CSRB on that. So you've written that up. And you also wrote about the Utils supply chain compromise in Linux. We're not going to talk about them though today because Adam Boileau and myself talked about both of those at length yesterday in the main Risky Business podcast in the other Risky Business RSS feed. So instead, we're actually going to check in with you on a couple of the shorter pieces you wrote this week, the first of which is looking at I shake my head like looking at this, looking at CISA's rules for cybersecurity incidents in like critical infrastructure. They've published their draft rules.
Yep.
And they're 447 pages long.
Yeah.
That's real useful. I can imagine everyone's just going to absorb that instantly.
Yeah, yeah. I described it as comically long. And what struck me is that the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, also has rules about what publicly listed companies should report to the market. And they're basically, is an incident material or not? And if it's material, you need to use this form and you need to report it. And so it's a very, very big picture kind of test. And it leaves a lot up to the companies themselves to make that determination. And that makes sense because every company's in a different position. How can the SEC know beforehand? We can't tell, you know, for any company whether it's material or not, given the unique circumstances. Now, this regulation that CISA, or proposed regulation that CISA has published, is basically seeking feedback on it, and it's targeted at the critical infrastructure sector, and it tries to define for all the different critical infrastructure sectors what's what's important or not, really, I guess, is what it boils down to.
So it's the opposite approach of the SEC, where it's like you have to make a determination and yep. We're not really going to give you any guidance. And that's a problem for one reason.
Yeah.
And then there's this one, which is ultra specific and is a problem for the opposite reason.
Yeah. And I guess part of the problem is that this legislation was passed a couple of years ago and they're still in the process of coming up with, you know, the 500-page document that defines what the rules are. And so this is one step, and then there's a feedback step, and then there's actually publishing the rule. And I had a look at the Australian equivalent, and it's basically a four-page document that says...
Let us know if something bad happens. Thanks.
Pretty much, yeah. If it's a significant incident, you need to tell us. And it has, I think... like it's captured in one sentence, really. And then the other three pages are sort of background, and then here's an example of one we think is critical and one that you wouldn't bother about. So DDoS is not critical unless it extends for a long time, and then you need to let us know. I think there's some there must be a cultural difference there as well in terms of how you run a government. And it always struck me that in Australia, we'd have two or three people doing a job. And in the US, you'd have 30 or 40 people doing the same job. And that exhibited itself in a lot more longer documents.
Are you talking back in your days in the intelligence community sort of?
Yeah, but also just generally, I think. Yeah, I think that's like you look at these kind of rulemaking proposals and they just go into a way more detail.
I have noticed, it's funny that you mentioned this, because I have noticed, obviously, you know, as an Australian running a business that does a lot with Americans, I've noticed that there is a big cultural difference when it comes to rulemaking. And in Australia, we seem a lot more comfortable with having rules and regulations that require regulators to exercise some common sense, yeah. right? Whereas Americans are really worried about bad faith interpretations of rules that they set up. So they wind up being, you know, hyper-specific so that everything's in policy and doesn't rely on any discretion, because it's almost like they don't trust their officials to act in good faith, whereas here we do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think there is something... I don't know if that's exactly it. I think there's elements of that. It's the same sort of phenomena where everything needs to be spelt out.
I mean, sorry, but the AA bill was an example of that, where people started plucking out, and they were Australians who were worried about this, but they were plucking out, you know, scenarios where they could imagine a developer being imprisoned because they refused to do something the government told them. And I think, you know, the government at the time just said, what? No, like, that's nuts. Like, that's not what this is about, and passed the law. And no developers have been sent to prison, Tom. Funnily enough.
Yeah, so I'd describe it as principles-based rather than rules-based.
Yeah.
And when it comes to getting stuff done quickly, it's a lot easier to have a principles-based approach.
Yeah.
And so I find it, is it troubling that you go through so much rule-making? Maybe it's just my personality. I just don't like pages and pages of rules.
Or maybe it's cultural, in that we're Australian and we look at this and we think that it's nuts.
Yeah.
So this regulation is called the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act, and comments are due in 60 days on it. I think we're going to see some submissions here, and they're going to be along the lines of, this is government overreach, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I can imagine that's the way this is going to go.
I mean, some of the problems are that when you're talking about critical infrastructure in the States, like, for example, in the water sector, it ranges from big utilities which have people who can do cyber stuff, all the way down to little, not exactly mum and pop.
Mom and pop sewage company.
That's right. Not exactly that, but close to that, where you might have just a couple of people doing the... cyber.
Yeah, working for the county, managing a facility.
Yeah. And so these rules have kind of carve-outs at different levels. But then you've also got to wonder, are those smaller utilities even able to read through and make sensible responses to this kind of legislation?
They're not even in a position to respond. I mean, I think we saw a big pushback a while ago. Forgive me if I'm getting some of the details wrong here, but I think there was a proposal to use the EPA to introduce cybersecurity requirements for, I think it was water utilities.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of pushback from the Republican Party in the US. And I thought just reflexively, well, this must be something dumb. But then when I looked at their argument, it was along those lines, which is, well, you know, you're about to lump a whole bunch of requirements on people who aren't really in a position to be able to adhere to those requirements, and getting the EPA to mandate cybersecurity is also, you know, overreach and whatever. And the case against, and I found it very surprising that I sort of looked at this case against a strict cybersecurity framework for a critical sector and kind of agreed with the people who said it was dumb.
Yeah, I think there's, as in many cases, two sides, right?
Yeah.
So in my argument, if I was to argue for that, would be that the risk environment has changed. And this is probably a perversion of natural justice in a sense, but the risk environment has changed. We know that there are state groups that are deliberately trying to compromise this type of infrastructure. From a government perspective, we need some tools to be able to make changes or influence changes in that sector. So we're going to take whatever we've got and try and shoehorn some kind of air quotes good into that by trying to raise standards.
Yeah.
And I think that's the sort of counter narrative. Like, it's the shortest, quickest way of getting some improvement in the sector. Having said that, those EPA regulations were never designed to do cybersecurity standards. So yes, it is fair enough to say that it's overreach. And so I think I wrote at the time that it, not exactly words to this effect, but it's kind of a trying to find a practical solution to the threats. And I think that was actually before news about Vault Typhoon broke. And so I think it was last week What the administration has resorted to is basically writing a letter to governors and asking nicely, please participate in this water security task force.
I mean, funnily enough, it's amazing how asking nicely can actually get you more than you expect in quite a lot of cases.
Yeah, and I think especially given the threat environment, it just makes sense for a lot of people to go, oh yeah, okay. So people are trying to actually possibly actively do us harm. Why don't we just at least figure out what we can do about it?
Might want to get on that.
That's right. Unite against a common enemy.
Yeah. Now, look, another thing you wrote about briefly this week is a FCC investigation or an FCC letter to telcos, basically asking them to have a look at their SS7, right? Have a look and see if any of their customers have been tracked via exploitation of weaknesses in SS7. I don't call them vulnerabilities because SS7 is just like an inherently weak thing. For those who are not familiar, SS7 is like the signaling system that glues telcos together, handles calls and whatnot, handles SMS-based messaging. I mean, it's been around for a long time. You've got your signal path and your traffic path, and you know SS7 is all of the signaling that sets up phone calls and whatnot. And if someone can pretend to be a telco, get access to the SS7 network, they can do things like geolocate to. I'm not even sure how closely. I know you can get the cell tower info.
Yeah, so I think it's a precise logical location, but you've got to map the logical to actually the physical. So if you've got really good knowledge of where the infrastructure is, I think it's pretty good.
Yeah. So you can do, tracking of people, but you can also do stuff like reroute their SMSs and their phone calls and whatever. And, getting on the SS7, it's ancient, and it's the reason why I mostly use applications over the top. For voice calls, I'll use FaceTime audio, I'll use WhatsApp, I'll use Signal. I don't like doing raw phone calls, basically, and that is the reason. So, it really is one of those situations where we're dealing with this, ancient protocol that is inherently weak. And now we've got this extremely specific examination from the FCC into the location tracking part of this. Why are they being so specific on this and they're just looking at the location tracking?
Yeah, look, to me it felt like the FCC's got a focus around geolocation tracking. And it's
kind of large.
And so there've been several actions in the last couple of months, and it feels like there's a big push on for geolocation in particular. And it seems
there was an executive order as well forbidding the sale of geolocation data to, it was all PII, wasn't it? But you got the sense that location data was pretty important to that executive order.
Yeah. And location data is important. I just got the feeling that reaching down into looking at SS7 and just carving out the geolocation part in particular, because the announcement's all about location. It doesn't deal with some of the
all the other bad stuff you can do with SS7.
Yeah, I just thought it was a bit strange. And I don't know, SS7 is just such a big legacy protocol. I was going to use a different word there, but the
you call it a giant pile of shit. What are you, Tom?
Words to that effect.
Words to that effect.
That just carving that out is quite. It just struck me as weird. That's not what I'd do.
Do you think, though? Look, being glass half full, which I sometimes am. Do you think that it's possible that by, asking telcos to take steps to prevent their customers' locations being tracked via SS7, just by virtue of, building those protections for the location tracking stuff, whether that's monitoring or better allow listing of, who can talk SS7 into their stuff, do you think that by virtue of doing that, they're going to just naturally solve some of those other problems that come with SS7 as well? Because if you're doing good monitoring, you're going to tidy up a lot of this stuff.
I think there's the actual idea behind the announcement, which is let's figure out what the problem is, how important it is, and how easy it is to solve, is a good one. So I will no doubt, when the report comes out, have a look at it and go, oh yeah, that's interesting, that's good. It just struck me that it's a weird way to kind of tackle that particular problem.
Ron Wyden's office has been making a lot of noise about this as well, right? So maybe there's a bit of politics at play here.
Yeah. And I also think that what you said right at the beginning is that the solution is actually to move away from, move towards IP-based solutions where you've got things like end-to-end encryption that can at least give you some guarantee that you're talking to the right person. The kind of security assumptions we're making today about the internet are more robust than the ones people were making when they came up with SS7.
It's funny, right? Because before we got recording, I was just looking through at what you'd written, and I clicked on the Wikipedia entry link that you've linked to for SS7, and I was getting like flashbacks to studying communications engineering in the mid-90s,
yeah,
and which is something I did. And I'm like, I'm having hard-out flashbacks. You know, I can smell the lecture hall.
Yeah, and can you remember them talking about security at all in those lectures?
I don't think so.
Yeah, and I think, the assumption probably was, all us telcos air quotes, good guys, and are trusted, and we're operating in a trusted environment. And ironically, I suppose the internet was set up in the same way, but then it's a lot easier to move endpoints to have, compensating controls, for pervasive insecurity.
Well, I think, the telco landscape these days is so Wild West, right? We had, I think it was last year, we spoke about Twitter's decision to stop doing SMS-based auth because they were getting scammed by people triggering SMSs with high termination fees and whatever. And we even played a clip from, Twitter owner and racist Elon Musk, where he was talking about that and just like the number of telcos out there and ones that are doing really shady stuff as well is just mind-boggling. So yeah, I guess we'll see how this one shakes out. But Tom Uren, thank you very much, mate, for having that conversation with me. We'll do it all again next week. And of course, if you would like to find and read Tom's newsletter, you can head over to news.risky.biz. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Patrick.